This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Portrait of a Spy by Daniel Silver, performed by Simon Vance. Jihad is becoming as American as apple pie and as British as afternoon tea. Anwar al-Awlaki, Al-Qaeda preacher and recruiter. One person of integrity can make a difference of life and death. Elie Wiesel. Part 1. Death in the Garden. 1. The Lizard Peninsula, Cornwall. It was the Rembrandt that solved the mystery once and for all. Afterward, in the quaint shops where they did their marketing and the dark little seaside pubs where they did their drinking, they would chide themselves for having missed the telltale signs, and they would share a good-natured laugh at some of their more outlandish theories about the true nature of his work. Because in their wildest dreams, there was not one among them who ever considered the possibility that the taciturn man from the far end of Gunwallow Cove was an art restorer, and a world-famous art restorer at that. He was not the first outsider to wander down to Cornwall with a secret to keep, yet few had guarded theirs more jealously, or with more style and intrigue. A case in point was the peculiar manner in which he had secured lodgings for himself and his beautiful but much younger wife. Having chosen the picturesque cottage at the edge of the cliffs, by all accounts sight unseen, he had paid the entire 12-month lease in advance, with all the paperwork handled discreetly by an obscure lawyer in Hamburg. He settled into the cottage a fortnight later, as if he were conducting a raid on a distant enemy outpost. Those who met him during his first forays into the village were struck by his notable lack of candour. He seemed to have no name, at least not one he was willing to share, and no country of origin that any of them could place. Duncan Reynolds, 30 years retired from the railroad and regarded as the worldliest of Gunwallow's residents, described him as a cipher of a man, while other reviews ranged from standoffish to unbearably rude. Even so, all agreed that, for better or worse, the little West Cornish village of Gunwallow had become a far more interesting place. With time, they were able to establish that his name was Giovanni Rossi, and that, like his beautiful wife, he was of Italian descent, which made it all the more curious when they began to notice government-issue cars filled with government-issue men prowling the streets of the village late at night. And then there were the two blokes who sometimes fished the cove. Opinion was universal that they were the worst fishermen anyone had ever seen. In fact, most assumed they were not fishermen at all. Naturally, as is wont to happen in a small village like Gunwallow, there began an intense debate about the true identity of the newcomer and the nature of his work. A debate that was finally resolved by Portrait of a Young Woman, oil on canvas, 104 by 86 centimetres, by Rembrandt van Rijn. Precisely when it arrived would never be clear. They assumed it was sometime in mid-January, because that was when they noticed a dramatic change in his daily routine. One day he was marching along the rugged cliff-tops of the Lizard Peninsula, as though wrestling with a guilty conscience. The next he was standing before an easel in his living room, a paintbrush in one hand, a palette in the other, and opera music blasting so loudly you could hear the wailing clear across Mounts Bay and Marazion. Given the proximity of his cottage to the coastal path, it was possible, if one paused in just the right spot, mind you, and craned one's neck at just the right angle, to see him in his studio. At first they assumed he was working on a painting of his own, but as the weeks ground slowly past, it became clear he was involved in the craft known as conservation, or more commonly as restoration.
"How's that mean?"
Malcolm Braithwaite, a retired lobsterman who smelled perpetually of the sea, asked one evening at the Lamb and Flag pub.
"It means he's fixing the bloody thing," said Duncan Reynolds. "A painting is like a living, breathing thing. When it gets old, it flakes and sags. Just like you, Malcolm. I hear it's a young girl."
"Pretty," said Duncan, nodding his head. "Cheeks like apples. She looks positively edible.
Do we know the artist?"
"Still working on that,"
And work on it they did. They consulted many books, searched many sites on the internet, and sought out people who knew more about art than they did, a category that included most of the population of West Cornwall. Finally, in early April, Dotty Cox from the village store screwed up the nerve to simply ask the beautiful young Italian woman about the painting when she came into town to do her marketing. The woman evaded the question with an ambiguous smile. Then, with her straw bag slung over her shoulder, she sauntered back down to the cove, her riotous dark hair tossed by the springtime wind. Within minutes of her arrival, the wailing of the opera ceased, and the window shades of the cottage fell like eyelids. They remained tightly closed for the next week, at which point the restorer and his beautiful wife disappeared, without warning. For several days the residents of Gunwarrow feared they might not be planning to return, and a few actually berated themselves for having snooped and pried into the couple's private affairs. Then, while leafing through the Times one morning at the village store, Dotty Cox noticed a story from Washington, D.C. about the unveiling of a long-lost portrait by Rembrandt. A portrait that looked precisely like the one that had been in the cottage at the far end of the cove. And thus the mystery was solved. Coincidentally, that same edition of the Times contained a front-page article about a series of mysterious explosions at four secret Iranian nuclear facilities. No one in Gunwallow imagined there might be any connection. At least not yet. The restorer was a changed man when he came back from America. They could see that. Though he remained guarded in his personal encounters, and he was still not the sort you would want to surprise in the dark, it was obvious a great burden had been lifted from his shoulders. They saw a smile on his angular face every now and again, and the light emitted by his unnaturally green eyes seemed a shade less defensive. Even his long daily walks had a different quality. Where once he had pounded along the footpaths like a man possessed, he now seemed to float atop the mist-covered cliffs like an Arthurian spirit who had come home after a long time in a distant land.
"Looks to me as if he's been released from a sacred vow," observed Vera Hobbs, owner of the village bait shop.
But when asked to venture a guess as to what that vow might have been, or to whom he had sworn it, she refused. Like everyone else in town, she had made a fool of herself trying to divine his occupation.
"Besides," she advised, "it's better to leave him in peace. Otherwise, the next time he and his pretty wife leave the Lizard, it might be for good."
Indeed, as that glorious summer slowly faded, the restorer's future plans became the primary preoccupation of the entire village. With the lease on the cottage running out in September, and with no tangible evidence he was planning to renew it, they embarked on a covert effort to persuade him to stay. What the restorer needed, they decided, was something to keep him tethered to the Cornish coast, a job that utilized his unique set of skills and gave him something to do other than walk the cliffs. Exactly what that job might entail, and who would give it to him, they had no idea, but they entrusted to themselves the delicate task of trying to find it. After much deliberation, it was Dotty Cox who finally hit upon the idea of the first annual Gunwallow Festival of Fine Arts, with the famous art restorer Giovanni Rossi serving as honorary chairman. She made the suggestion to the restorer's wife the following morning when she popped into the village store at her usual time. The woman actually laughed for several minutes. The offer was flattering, she said after regaining her composure, but she didn't think it was the sort of thing Signor Rossi would agree to. His official rejection came soon after, and the Gunwallow Festival of Fine Arts quietly withered on the vine. It was no matter. A few days later, they learned that the restorer had taken the cottage for another year. Once again, the lease was paid in full, with all the paperwork handled by the same obscure lawyer in Hamburg. With that, life returned to something like normal. They would see the restorer in mid-morning when he came to the village with his wife to do their marketing, and they would see him again in mid-afternoon when he hiked along the cliff tops in his barber coat and his flat cap pulled low over his brow. And if he failed to give them a proper greeting, they took no offence. And if he seemed uneasy about something, they gave him room to work it out on his own. And if a stranger came to town, they tracked his every move until he was gone. The restorer and his wife might have come from Italy originally, but they belonged to Cornwall now, and heaven help the fool who ever tried to take them away again. There were, however, some on the Lizard who believed there was more to the story, and one man in particular who believed he knew what it was. His name was Teddy Sinclair, owner of a rather good pizzeria in Helston, and a subscriber to conspiracy theories large and small. Teddy believed the moon landings were a hoax. Teddy believed 9/11 was an inside job. And Teddy believed the man from Gunwallow Cove was hiding more than a secret ability to heal paintings. To prove his case once and for all, he summoned the villagers to the Lamb and Flag on the second Thursday of November and unveiled a chart that looked a bit like the periodic table of elements. It purported to establish, beyond the shadow of a doubt, that the explosions at the Iranian nuclear facilities were the work of a legendary Israeli intelligence officer named Gabriel Alon, and that the same Gabriel Alon was now living peacefully in Gunwallow under the name Giovanni Rossi. When the laughter finally died down, Duncan Reynolds called it the dumbest thing he'd heard since some Frenchman decided that Europe should have a common currency. But this time Teddy stood his ground, which in hindsight was the right thing to do, because Teddy might have been wrong about the moon landings and wrong about 9/11, but when it came to the man from Gunwallow Cove, his theory was in every respect true. The next morning, Remembrance Day, the village woke to the news that the restorer and his wife had disappeared. In a panic, Vera Hobbs hurried down to the cove and peered through the windows of the cottage. The restorer's supplies were scattered across a low table, and propped on the easel was a painting of a nude woman stretched upon a couch. It took Vera a moment to realize that the couch was identical to the one in the living room, and that the woman was the same one she saw each morning in her bake shop. Despite her embarrassment, Vera couldn't seem to summon the will to look away, because it happened to be one of the most strikingly beautiful paintings she had ever seen. It was also a very good sign, she thought as she headed back to the village. A painting like that was not the sort of thing a man left behind when he was making a run for it. Eventually, the restorer and his wife would come back. And heaven help that bloody Teddy Sinclair if they didn't. 2. Paris. The first bomb exploded at 11:46 a.m. on the Avenue des Champs-Élysées in Paris. The director of the French security service would later say he received no warning of the impending attack, a statement his detractors might have found laughable with a death toll not so high. The warning signs were plain to see, they said. Only the blind or the willfully ignorant could have possibly missed them. From Europe's point of view, the timing of the attack could not have been worse. After decades of lavish social spending, much of the continent was teetering on the brink of fiscal and monetary disaster. Its debt was soaring, its treasuries were empty, and its pampered citizenry was aging and disillusioned. Austerity was the order of the day. In the current climate, no cow was considered too sacred. Healthcare, university tuition, support for the arts, and even pension benefits were all undergoing drastic cuts. Along Europe's so-called periphery, the smaller economies were falling like dominoes. Greece was sinking slowly into the Aegean, Spain was on life support, and the Irish miracle had turned out to be nothing more than a mirage. In the smart salons of Brussels, many Eurocrats were daring to say aloud what had once been unthinkable, that the dream of European integration was dying, and in their darker moments a few of them actually wondered whether Europe, as they knew it, might be dying too. Another article of faith lay in tatters that November. The belief that Europe could absorb an endless tide of Muslim immigrants from its former colonies while preserving its culture and basic way of life. What had started as a temporary program to relieve a post-war labor shortage had now permanently altered the face of an entire continent. Restive Muslim suburbs ringed nearly every city, and several countries appeared demographically fated to Muslim majorities before the end of the century. No one in a position of power had bothered to consult the native population of Europe before throwing open the doors, and now, after years of relative passivity, the natives were beginning to push back. Denmark had imposed draconian restrictions on immigrant marriages. France had banned the wearing of the full facial veil in public. And the Swiss, who barely tolerated one another, had decided they wanted to keep their tidy little cities and towns free of unsightly minarets. The leaders of Britain and Germany had declared multiculturalism, the virtual religion of post-Christian Europe, a dead letter. No longer would the majority bend to the will of the minority, they declared. Nor would it turn a blind eye to the extremism that flourished within its midst. Europe's age-old contest with Islam, it seemed, had entered a new and potentially dangerous phase. There were many who feared it would be an uneven fight. One side was old, tired, and largely content with itself. The other could be driven into a murderous frenzy by a doodle in a Danish newspaper. Nowhere were the problems facing Europe on clearer display than in Clichy-sous-Bois, the volatile Arab banlieue located just outside Paris. The flashpoint for the deadly riots that swept France in 2005, the suburb had one of the country's highest unemployment rates, along with one of the highest rates of violent crime. So dangerous was Clichy-sous-Bois that even the French police refrained from entering its seething public housing estates, including the one where Nazim Kadir, a 26-year-old Algerian employed by the celebrated Fouquet's restaurant, lived with 12 other members of his extended family. On that morning in November, he left his apartment in darkness to purify himself at a mosque built with Saudi money and staffed by a Saudi-trained imam who spoke no French. After completing this most important pillar of Islam, he rode a 601 AB bus to the suburb of Lorency, and then boarded an arrière train to the Gare Saint-Lazare. There he switched to the Paris metro for the final leg of his journey. At no point did he arouse the suspicions of the authorities or his fellow passengers. His heavy coat concealed the fact he was wearing an explosive vest. He emerged from the George V stop at his usual time, 11:40, and started up the Avenue des Champs-Élysées. Those lucky enough to survive the inferno to come would later say there was nothing unusual in his appearance, though the owner of a popular flower shop claimed to notice a curious determination in his gait as he closed in on the entrance of the restaurant. Among those standing outside were a deputy minister of justice, a newsreader from French television, a fashion model currently gracing the cover of Vogue magazine, a gypsy beggar clutching the hand of a small child, and a noisy group of Japanese tourists. The bomber made one final check of his watch. Then he unzipped his coat. It was never clearly established whether the act was preceded by the traditional scream of Allahu Akbar. Several survivors claimed to have heard it. Several others swore the bomber detonated his device in silence. As for the sound of the explosion itself, those closest had no memory of it at all, for their eardrums were too badly damaged. To a person, all recalled seeing a blinding white flash of light. "It was the light of death," said one. "The light one sees at the moment he confronts God for the first time." The bomb itself was a marvel of design and construction. It was not the kind of device built from internet manuals or the how-to pamphlets floating around the Salafist mosques of Europe. It had been perfected under battle conditions in Palestine and Mesopotamia. Packed with nails, soaked in rat poison, a practice borrowed from the suicide bombers of Hamas, it carved through the crowd like a circular saw. So powerful was the explosion that the Louvre Pyramid, located a mile and a half to the east, shivered with the blast wave. Those closest to the bomber were blown to pieces, sheared in half, or decapitated, the preferred punishment for unbelievers. Even at 40 paces, limbs were lost. At the farthest edge of the kill zone, the dead appeared pristine. Spared outward trauma, they had been killed by the shock wave, which ravaged their internal organs like a tsunami. Providence had granted them the tender mercy of bleeding to death in private. The first gendarmes to arrive were instantly sickened by what they saw. Extremities littered the paving stones along with shoes, smashed wristwatches frozen at 11:46, and mobile phones that rang unanswered. In one final insult, the murderer's remains were scattered among his victims, everything but the head, which came to rest on a delivery truck more than 100 feet away, the bomber's expression oddly serene. The French Interior Minister arrived within 10 minutes of the explosion. Seeing the carnage, he declared, "Baghdad has come to Paris." 17 minutes later, it came to the Tivoli Gardens in Copenhagen, where at 12:03 p.m., a second suicide bomber detonated himself amid a large group of children waiting impatiently to board the park's roller coaster. The Danish Security Service, the PET, quickly established that the Shahid had been born in Copenhagen, had attended Danish schools, and was married to a Danish woman. It seemed not to trouble him that his own children attended the same school as his victims. For the security professionals across Europe, it was the nightmare scenario come true, coordinated and highly sophisticated attacks that appeared to have been planned and executed by a skilled mastermind. They feared the terrorists would strike again soon, though two critical pieces of information eluded them. They did not know where, and they did not know when. 3. St. James's, London. Later, the Counter-Terrorism Command of London's Metropolitan Police Service would expend much valuable time and effort trying to reconstruct the movements that morning of one Gabriel Allon, the legendary but wayward son of Israeli intelligence, now formally retired and living quietly in the United Kingdom. It is known, based on eyewitness accounts from his meddlesome neighbours, that he departed his cottage in Cornwall a few minutes after dawn, and climbed into his Range Rover accompanied by his beautiful Italian-born wife, Chiara. It is also known, due to Britain's Orwellian system of CCTV cameras, that the couple reached central London in near record time, and that, through an act of divine intervention, they managed to find a somewhat legal parking space in Piccadilly. From there they proceeded on foot to Mason's Yard, a tranquil quadrangle of paving stones and commerce in St. James's, and presented themselves at the door of Isherwood Fine Arts. According to the CCTV camera in the yard, they were admitted into the premises at 11:40 London time, though Maggie, Isherwood's latest mediocre secretary, would erroneously record the time in her logbook as 11:45. Purveyors of museum-quality Italian and Dutch old master paintings since 1968, the gallery had once occupied a lofty perch on Tony New Bond Street in Mayfair. Driven into St. Jamesian exile by the likes of Hermès, Burberry and Cartier, it had taken refuge in three floors of a sagging warehouse, once owned by Fortnum and Mason. Among the incestuous, back-biting villagers of St. James's, the gallery had always been regarded as rather good theatre. Comedy and tragedy, stunning highs and seemingly bottomless lows, and always a whiff of conspiracy lying just beneath the surface. This was, in large measure, a consequence of the owner's personality. Julian Isherwood was cursed with a near-fatal flaw for an art dealer. He liked to possess art more than he liked to sell it. As a result, he was burdened with a large inventory of what is affectionately known in the trade as dead stock, paintings for which no buyer would ever pay a fair price. It was rumoured that Isherwood's personal holdings rivalled those of the British royal family. Even Gabriel, who had restored paintings for the gallery for more than 30 years, had only the vaguest idea of Isherwood's true holdings. They found him in his office, a tall, slightly precarious figure, tilted against the front of a desk piled with old catalogues and monographs. He wore a grey chalk-striped suit and a lavender necktie that had been given to him the previous evening by his latest love interest. As usual, he appeared slightly hungover, a look he cultivated. His eyes were fixed mournfully on the television. "I take it you've heard the news?" Gabriel nodded slowly. He and Chiara had heard the first bulletins on the radio as they were passing through the western suburbs of London. The images playing out on the screen were remarkably similar to the ones that had formed in Gabriel's own mind— the dead covered in plastic sheeting, the bloodied survivors, the onlookers with their palms pressed to their faces in horror. It never changed. He supposed it never would. "I had lunch at Fouquet's last week with a client," Isherwood said, running a hand through his longish grey locks. "We parted company on the very spot where that maniac detonated his bomb. What if the client had scheduled the lunch for today? I might have been—" Isherwood stopped himself. It was a typical reaction after an attack, thought Gabriel. The living always sought to find some connection, however tenuous, to the dead. "The bomber in Copenhagen killed children," Isherwood said. "Will you please explain to me what cause is served by the murder of innocent children?" "Fear," said Gabriel. "They want us to be afraid." "When is this going to end?" Isherwood asked, shaking his head in disgust. "When in God's name is this madness going to end?" "You should know better than to ask a question like that, Julian." Gabriel lowered his voice and added,
After all, you've had a ringside seat at this war for a very long time.
Isherwood gave a melancholy smile. His backbone of England surname and English scale concealed the fact that he was not, at least technically, English at all. British by nationality and passport, yes, but German by birth, French by upbringing, and Jewish by religion. Only a handful of trusted friends knew that Isherwood had staggered into London as a child refugee in 1942, after being carried across the snowbound Pyrenees by a pair of Basque shepherds, or that his father, the renowned Paris art dealer Samuel Isakovitz, had been murdered at the Sobibor death camp along with Isherwood's mother. Though Isherwood had carefully guarded the secrets of his past, the story of his dramatic escape from Nazi-occupied Europe had reached the ears of Israel's secret intelligence service. And in the mid-1970s, during a wave of Palestinian terrorist attacks against Israeli targets in Europe, he was recruited as a Sayan, a volunteer helper. Isherwood had but one assignment, to assist in building and maintaining the operational cover of an art restorer and assassin named Gabriel Allon.
"Just keep one thing in mind," Isherwood said. "You work for me now, not them. This isn't your problem, Petal. Not anymore."
He aimed his remote at the television, and the mayhem in Paris and Copenhagen vanished, at least for the moment.
"Let's have a look at something beautiful, shall we?"
The limited space of the gallery had compelled Isherwood to arrange his empire vertically. Storerooms on the ground floor, business offices on the second and on the third, a glorious formal exhibition room modelled on Paul Rosenberg's famous gallery in Paris, where young Julian had spent many happy hours as a child. As they entered the room, midday sun was slanting through the overhead skylight, illuminating a large oil painting propped on a baize-covered pedestal. It was a depiction of the Madonna and Child with Mary Magdalene, set against an evening backdrop, quite obviously of the Venetian school. Chiara removed her car-length leather coat and sat on the museum-style ottoman at the centre of the room. Gabriel stood directly before the canvas, one hand resting on his narrow chin, his head tilted to one side.
"Where did you find it?"
"In a great limestone pile along the Norfolk coast."
"Does the pile have an owner?"
"Insists on anonymity. Suffice it to say, he descends from a family of title. His property holdings are enormous, and his cash reserves are dwindling at an alarming rate."
"So he asked you to take a few paintings off his hands to keep him afloat for another year."
"At the rate he goes through money, I'd give him 2 months at the outside."
"How much did you pay for it?"
$20,000.
"How charitable of you, Julian."
Gabriel glanced at Isherwood and added,
"I assume you covered your tracks by taking a few other pictures as well?"
"Six worthless pieces of crap," Isherwood confessed. "But if my hunch about this one is correct, they were well worth the investment."
"Provenance?" asked Gabriel.
"It was purchased in the Veneto by one of the owner's ancestors while he was doing his grand tour in the early 19th century. It's been in the family ever since."
"Current attribution?"
"Workshop of Palma Vecchio."
"Really?" asked Gabriel skeptically.
"According to whom?"
"The Italian art expert who brokered the sale." "Was he blind?"
"Only in one eye."
Gabriel smiled. Many of the Italians who had advised British nobility during their travels were charlatans who did a brisk trade in worthless copies falsely attributed to the masters of Florence and Venice. Occasionally they erred in the opposite direction. Isherwood suspected that the painting on the pedestal fell into the second category. So too did Gabriel. He dragged the tip of his forefinger over the face of the Magdalene, dislodging a century's worth of surface grime.
"Where was it hung? In a coal mine?"
He picked at the heavily discoloured varnish. In all likelihood it was composed of a mastic or damar resin that had been dissolved with turpentine. Removing it would be a painstaking process involving the use of a carefully calibrated mixture of acetone, methyl peroxidol, and mineral spirits. Gabriel could only imagine the horrors that awaited him once the old varnish had been stripped away. Archipelagos of pentimento, a desert of surface cracks and creases, wholesale paint losses concealed by previous restorations. And then there was the condition of the canvas, which was sagging dramatically with age. The remedy was a relining, a perilous procedure involving the application of heat, moisture, and pressure. Any restorer who had ever performed a relining had the scars to prove it. Gabriel had once destroyed a large portion of a painting by Domenico Zampieri by using an iron with a faulty temperature gauge. The fully restored painting, while pristine to the untrained eye, was definitely a collaborative effort between Zampieri and the studio of Gabriel alone.
"Well?" asked Isherwood again.
"Who painted the bloody thing?"
Gabriel made a show of deliberation.
"I need x-rays to make a definitive attribution.
My man is dropping by later this afternoon to take the pictures, but we both know that you don't need them to make a preliminary attribution. You're like me, Peddle. You've been around paintings for 100,000 years. You know it when you see it."
Gabriel fished a small magnifying glass from his coat pocket and used it to examine the brush strokes. Leaning slightly forward, he could feel the familiar shape of a Beretta 9mm pistol digging into the flesh of his left hip. Having worked with British intelligence to sabotage the Iranian nuclear program, he was now permitted to carry a weapon at all times for protection. He had also been granted a British passport, which he was free to use for foreign travel, provided he was not working for his old service. There was no chance of that. The illustrious career of Gabriel Alon was finally over. He was no longer Israel's avenging angel. He was an art restorer, employed by Isherwood Fine Arts, and England was his home.
"You have a hunch," said Isherwood. "I can see it in those green eyes of yours."
"I do," replied Gabriel, still entranced by the brush strokes. "But I'd like a second opinion first."
He glanced over his shoulder at Chiara. She was toying with a strand of her unruly hair, a slightly bemused expression on her face. Posed as she was now, she bore a striking resemblance to the woman in the painting. It was hardly surprising, thought Gabriel. The descendant of Jews expelled from Spain in 1492, Chiara had been raised in the ancient ghetto of Venice. It was quite possible some of her ancestors had served as models for masters such as Bellini, Veronese, and Tintoretto.
"What do you think?" he asked.
Chiara joined Gabriel before the canvas and clucked her tongue in disapproval at its deplorable condition. Though she had studied the Roman Empire at university, she had assisted Gabriel on a number of restorations and, in the process, had become a formidable art historian in her own right.
"It's an excellent example of a holy conversation, or sacra conversazione, an idyllic scene in which subjects are grouped against an aesthetically pleasing landscape. And as any oaf knows, Palma Vecchio is regarded as the originator of the form."
"What do you think of the draftsmanship?" Isherwood asked, a lawyer leading a sympathetic witness.
"It's awfully good for Palma," Chiara replied. "His palette was unrivaled, but he was never regarded as a particularly skilled draftsman, even by his contemporaries."
"And the woman who posed as the Madonna?"
"Unless I'm mistaken, which is highly unlikely, her name is Violante. She appears in a number of Palma's paintings. But there was another famous painter in Venice at the time who was said to be quite fond of her. His name was..."
"Tiziano Vecellio," Isherwood said, completing the thought for her. "Better known as Titian." "Congratulations, Julian," Gabriel said, smiling. "You just snared a Titian for the paltry sum of £20,000. Now you just need to find a restorer, capable of knocking it into shape."
"How much?" Isherwood asked.
Gabriel pulled a frown.
"It's going to take a great deal of work."
"How much?" Isherwood repeated.
200,000. "I could find someone else for half that."
"That's true. But we both remember what happened the last time you tried that."
"How soon can you start?"
"I'll have to check my calendar before making any commitments.
I'll give you an advance of 100,000.
"In that case, I can start right away."
"I'll send it to Cornwall the day after tomorrow," Isherwood said. "The question is, when will I have it back?"
Gabriel made no response. He stared at his wristwatch for a moment as though it were no longer keeping proper time, then tilted his face thoughtfully toward the skylight. Isherwood placed a hand gently on his shoulder.
"It's not your problem, Petal," he said. "Not anymore."
4. Covent Garden, London. A police checkpoint near Leicester Square had brought the traffic on Charing Cross Road to a standstill. Gabriel and Chiara hurried through a fog bank of exhaust fumes and set out along Cranbourne Street. It was lined with pubs and coffee bars, catering to the herds of tourists who seemed to wander aimlessly through Soho at all hours, regardless of the season. For now, Gabriel seemed oblivious to them. He was staring at the screen of his mobile phone. The death tolls in Paris and Copenhagen were rising.
"How bad?" asked Chiara.
28 on the Champs-Élysées, and another 37 at the Tivoli Gardens.
"Do they have any idea who's responsible?"
asked Chiara.
"It's still too early," Gabriel said, "but the French think it might be Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb."
"Could they have pulled off a pair of coordinated attacks like this?"
"They have cells scattered across Europe and North America. But the analysts at King Saul Boulevard have always been skeptical of their ability to carry out a Bin Laden-style spectacular."
King Saul Boulevard was the address of Israel's Foreign Intelligence Service. It had a long and deliberately misleading name that had very little to do with the true nature of its work. Those who worked there referred to it as the office, and nothing else. Even retired agents like Gabriel and Chiara never uttered the organization's real name.
"It doesn't feel like Bin Laden to me," Chiara said. "It feels more like..."
"Baghdad," said Gabriel. "These death tolls are high for open-air attacks. It suggests the bomb-maker knew what he was doing. If we're lucky, he left behind his signature."
"We?" asked Chiara.
Gabriel wordlessly returned the phone to his coat pocket. They had reached the chaotic traffic circle at the end of Cranbourne Street. There were two Italian restaurants, the Spaghetti House and Bella Italia. He looked at Chiara and asked her to choose.
"I'm not going to start my long weekend in London at Bella Italia," she said, frowning. "You promised to take me to a proper lunch."
"In my opinion, one can do far worse in London than Bella Italia."
"Unless one was born in Venice."
Gabriel smiled.
"We have a reservation at a lovely place called Orso in Wellington Street. It's very Italian. I thought we could walk through Covent Garden on our way."
"Do you still feel up to it?"
"We have to eat," he said, "and the walk will do us both good."
They hurried across the traffic circle into Garrick Street, where two Metropolitan Police officers in lime-green coats were questioning the Arab-looking driver of a white panel van. The anxiety of the pedestrians was almost palpable. In some of the faces, Gabriel saw genuine fear. In others, a grim resolution to carry on as normal. Chiara held his hand tightly as they strolled past the shop windows. She had been looking forward to this weekend for a long time and was determined not to let the news from Paris and Copenhagen spoil it.
"You were a bit hard, Don Julian," she said. 200,000 is twice your usual fee."
"It's a tition, Chiara. Julian is going to do quite nicely."
"The least you could have done is accept his invitation to a celebratory lunch."
"I didn't want to have lunch with Julian. I wanted to have lunch with you."
"He has an idea he wants to discuss."
"What sort of idea?"
"A partnership," Chiara said.
"He wants us to become partners in the gallery."
Gabriel slowed to a stop.
"Let me make this as clear as possible," he said. "I have absolutely no interest in becoming a partner in the sometimes solvent firm of Isherwood Fine Arts."
"Why not?"
"For one thing," he said, walking again, "we have no idea how to run a business."
"You've run several very thriving enterprises in the past. It's easy when you have the backing of an intelligence service." "You're not giving yourself enough credit, Gabriel. How hard can it be to run an art gallery?"
"Incredibly hard. And as Julian has proven time and time again, it's easy to get into trouble. Even the most successful gallery can go under if it places a bad bet."
Gabriel gave her a sidelong look and asked,
"When did you and Julian concoct this little arrangement?"
"You make it sound as if we were conspiring behind your back."
"That's because you were."
With a smile, Chiara conceded the point.
"It happened when we were in Washington for the unveiling of the Rembrandt. Julian pulled me aside and said he was beginning to think about the possibility he might actually retire. He wants the gallery to end up in the hands of someone he trusts."
Julian will never retire.
I wouldn't be so sure about that.
Where was I when this deal was being hatched?
I believe you'd slipped outside for a private conversation with a British investigative reporter.
Why didn't you tell me about any of this until now?
Because Julian asked me not to.
With his edgy silence, Gabriel made it clear that Chiara had violated one of the fundamental tenets of their marriage. Secrets, even undeniably trivial ones, were forbidden.
I'm sorry, Gabriel. I should have said something, but Julian was adamant. He knew your first instinct would be to say no.
He could sell the gallery to Oliver Dimbleby in a heartbeat and retire to an island in the Caribbean.
Have you considered what that might mean for us? Do you really want to clean pictures for Oliver Dimbleby? Or Giles Pittaway? Or were you thinking you could scrape up a bit of freelance work from the Tate or the National Gallery?
It sounds as if you and Julian have it all worked out.
We do.
Then perhaps you should become Julian's partner.
Only if you clean pictures for me.
Gabriel could see that Chiara was serious.
Running a gallery isn't all about attending glamorous auctions and having long lunches in fancy restaurants in Jermyn Street, and it's not something that should be considered a hobby.
Thank you for dismissing me as a dilettante.
That's not what I meant, and you know it.
You're not the only one who's retired from the office, Gabriel. I am too. But unlike you, I don't have damaged old masters to occupy my time.
So you want to become an art dealer? You'll spend your days rummaging through piles of mediocre paintings looking for another lost Titian, and chances are you'll never find one.
It doesn't sound that bad to me.
Chiara looked around the street.
And it means we could live here.
I thought you liked Cornwall.
I adore it, she said. Just not in winter.
Gabriel lapsed into silence. He'd been bracing himself for a conversation like this for some time.
I thought we were going to have a baby, he said.
So did I, Chiara said. But I'm beginning to think it might not be possible. Nothing I try seems to be working.
There was a note of resignation in her voice that Gabriel had never heard before.
So we'll keep trying, he said.
I just don't want you to be disappointed. It was the miscarriage. It's going to make it much harder for me to ever conceive again. Who knows? A change of scenery might help. Just think about it, she said, squeezing his hand. That's all I'm saying, darling. We might actually enjoy living here.
In the broad Italianate piazza of the Covent Garden Market, a street comedian was arranging a pair of unsuspecting German tourists into a pose suggestive of sexual intimacy. Chiara leaned against a pillar to watch the performance, while Gabriel fell into an undignified sulk, his eyes scanning the large crowd gathered in the square and atop the balcony bar of the Punch and Judy. He was not angry with Chiara, but with himself. For years their relationship had revolved around Gabriel and his work. It had never occurred to him that Chiara might have career aspirations of her own. If they were a normal couple, he might have considered the opportunity. But they were not a normal couple. They were former operatives of one of the world's most celebrated intelligence services, and they had a past that was far too bloody to lead so public a life. As they headed into the soaring glass arcade of the market, any residual tension from their quarrel quickly dissipated. Even Gabriel, who detested shopping in all its forms, took pleasure in roaming the colourful shops and stalls with Chiara at his side. Intoxicated by the smell of her hair, he imagined the afternoon that lay ahead. A quiet lunch, followed by a pleasant walk back to their hotel. There, in the cool shadows of their room, Gabriel would slowly undress Chiara and make love to her in the enormous bed. For a moment it was almost possible for Gabriel to imagine his past had been erased, that his exploits were mere fables gathering dust in the file rooms of King Saul Boulevard. Only the watchfulness remained, the instinctive, gnawing vigilance that made it impossible for him to ever feel completely at peace in public. It forced him to make a mental charcoal sketch of every passing face in the crowded market. And in Wellington Street, as they were approaching the restaurant, it caused him to freeze in his tracks. Chiara tugged playfully at his arm. Then she stared directly into his eyes and realized something was wrong.
You look as though you just saw a ghost.
Not a ghost. A dead man.
Where?
Gabriel nodded toward a figure in a grey woolen overcoat.
Right there.
5. Covent Garden, London. There are telltale indicators common to suicide bombers. Lips can move involuntarily as final prayers are recited. Eyes can have a glassy, thousand-yard stare. And the face can sometimes appear unnaturally pale, evidence that an unkempt beard has been hastily removed in preparation for a mission. The dead man exhibited none of these traits. His lips were pursed. His eyes were clear and focused, and his face was evenly coloured. He had been shaving regularly for a long time. What set him apart was the thin tributary of sweat leaking from his left sideburn. Why was he perspiring on a crisp autumn afternoon? If he was warm, why were his hands buried in the pockets of his woolen overcoat? And why was the overcoat, a size too large in Gabriel's opinion, still tightly buttoned? And then there was his walk. Even a physically fit man in his late 20s will have difficulty feigning a normal gait when saddled with 50 pounds of high explosives, nails and ball bearings. As the dead man walked past Gabriel in Wellington Street, he appeared unusually erect, as if he were trying to compensate for the added weight around his abdomen and kidneys. The fabric of his gabardine trousers vibrated with each step, as though the joints in his hips and knees were shuddering beneath the burden of the bomb. It was possible that the perspiring young man with the oversized coat was an innocent who simply needed to do a bit of midday shopping, but Gabriel suspected otherwise. He believed the man walking a few paces ahead represented the finale of a continent-wide day of terror, first Paris, then Copenhagen, and now London. Gabriel ordered Chiara to take shelter in the restaurant and quickly crossed to the opposite pavement. He shadowed the dead man for approximately 100 yards, then watched as he rounded the corner into the entrance of the Covent Garden Market. There were 2 cafes on the eastern side of the piazza, each filled with lunchtime patrons. Standing between them in a patch of sunlight were 3 uniformed Metropolitan Police Service officers. None took notice of the dead man as he entered the market arcade. Gabriel now had a decision to make. The most obvious course of action was to tell the police of his suspicions. Obvious, he thought, but not necessarily optimal. In all likelihood, the police would respond to Gabriel's approach by pulling him aside for questioning, wasting several precious seconds. Worse still, they might confront the man, a ploy that would almost certainly cause him to detonate his weapon. Although virtually every officer on the Met had been given basic instruction in counter-terrorism tactics, few had the experience or firepower necessary to take down a committed jihadist bent on martyrdom. Gabriel had both, and he had acted against suicide bombers before. He glided past the 3 officers and slipped inside the arcade. The dead man was now 20 yards ahead, moving at a parade ground clip along the elevated walkway of the main hall. Gabriel reckoned he was carrying enough explosives and shrapnel to kill everyone within a 75-foot radius. Doctrine dictated that Gabriel remain beyond the lethal blast zone until it was time to make his move. The environment, however, compelled him to close the distance and place himself in greater danger. A headshot from 75 feet was difficult under the best of circumstances, even for a gunman with the skills of Gabriel alone. In a crowded shopping arcade, it would be next to impossible. Gabriel felt his mobile phone vibrate softly in his coat pocket. Ignoring it, he watched as the dead man paused along the railing of the walkway to check his watch. Gabriel took note of the fact it was worn on the left wrist, which meant the detonator switch was almost certainly in the right hand. But why would a suicide bomber stop on his way to martyrdom to check the time? The most likely explanation was that he had been ordered to end his life and the lives of many innocent people at a precise moment. Gabriel suspected there might be some sort of symbolism involved. There usually was. The terrorists of Al-Qaeda and its offshoots loved symbolism, especially when it involved numbers. Gabriel was now close enough to the dead man to see his eyes. They were clear and focused, an encouraging sign. It meant he was still thinking about his mission rather than the carnal delights awaiting him in paradise. When he started dreaming of the perfumed, dark-eyed houris, it would show on his face. Then Gabriel would have a choice to make. for now he needed the dead man to stay in this world a little longer. The dead man made another check of the time. Gabriel glanced quickly at his own watch. 2:34. He ran the numerals through the database of his memory, looking for any connection. He added them, subtracted them, multiplied them, reversed them, and rearranged their order. And then he thought about the two previous attacks. The first occurred at 11:46, the second at 12:03. It was possible the times were representative of years on the Gregorian calendar, but Gabriel could find no connection. He mentally erased the hours of the attacks and focused only on the minutes. 46 minutes passed. 3 minutes passed. Then he understood. The times were as familiar to him as the brush strokes of Titian. 46 minutes passed. 3 minutes passed. They were two of the most famous moments in the history of terrorism. The exact times at which the two hijacked airliners struck the World Trade Center on 9/11. American Airlines Flight 11 crashed into the North Tower at 8:46 a.m. United Airlines Flight 175 struck the South Tower at 9:03 a.m. The third plane to successfully hit its target that morning was American Airlines Flight 77, which was flown into the western side of the Pentagon. The local time had been 9:37 a.m., 2:37 p.m. in London. Gabriel checked his digital watch. It was now a few seconds past 2:35. Looking up, he saw the man in the grey overcoat was once again moving at a brisk pace, hands in his pockets, seemingly oblivious to the people around him. As Gabriel followed, his mobile began to vibrate again. This time he answered and heard the voice of Chiara. He told her that a suicide bomber was about to detonate himself in Covent Garden, and instructed her to make contact with MI5. Then he slipped the phone back into his pocket and began closing the distance between himself and the target. He feared that many innocent people were about to die, and he wondered whether there was anything he could do to stop it. 6. Covent Garden, London. There was one other possibility, of course. The possibility that the man walking several paces ahead of Gabriel had nothing beneath his coat but a few extra pounds of body fat. Inevitably, Gabriel recalled the case of Jean-Charles de Menezes, the Brazilian-born electrician who was shot to death by British police in London's Stockwell tube station after being mistaken for a wanted Islamic militant. British prosecutors declined to bring charges against the officers involved in the killing, a decision that provoked outrage among human rights activists and civil libertarians around the world. Gabriel knew that under similar circumstances he could expect no such leniency. It meant he would have to be certain before acting. He was confident of one thing. He believed the bomber, like a painter, would sign his name before pressing his detonator switch. He would want his victims to know that their imminent deaths were not without purpose, that they were being sacrificed in the name of the sacred jihad and in the name of Allah. For the moment, though, Gabriel had no choice but to follow the man and wait. Slowly, carefully, he closed the gap, making small adjustments in his own course to maintain an unobstructed firing lane. His eyes were focused on the lower portion of the man's skull. A few centimeters beneath it was the brain stem, essential for controlling the motor and sensory systems of the rest of the body. Destroy the brain stem with several rounds of ammunition, and the bomber would lack the means to press his detonator button. Miss the brain stem, and it was possible the martyr could carry out his mission with a dying twitch. Gabriel was one of the few men in the world who had actually killed a terrorist before he could carry out his attack. He knew the difference between success and failure would come down to a fraction of a second. Success meant only one would die. Failure would result in the deaths of scores of innocent people, perhaps even Gabriel himself. The dead man passed through the doorway leading to the piazza. It was far more crowded now. A cellist was playing a suite by Bach. A Jimi Hendrix impersonator was grappling with an amplified electric guitar. A well-dressed man standing atop a wooden crate was shouting something about God and the Iraq War. The dead man headed directly toward the center of the square, where the comedian's performance had sunk to new depths of depravity, much to the delight of the large crowd of spectators. Using techniques learned in his youth, Gabriel mentally silenced the noises around him one by one, starting with the faint strains of the Bach suite and ending with the uproarious laughter of the crowd. Then he glanced one last time at his wristwatch and waited for the dead man to sign his name. It was 2:36. The dead man had reached the outer edge of the large crowd. He paused for a few seconds as if searching for a weak point to make his entry, then shouldered his way between two startled women. Gabriel entered at a different point, several yards to the man's right, slipping virtually unnoticed through a family of American tourists. The crowd was four deep in most places and tightly packed, which presented Gabriel with yet another dilemma. The ideal ammunition for a situation like this was a hollow point round which would inflict greater tissue damage on the target and substantially reduce the risk of collateral casualties due to over-penetration, but Gabriel's Beretta pistol was loaded with ordinary 9mm parabellum rounds. As a result, he would have to position himself to fire at an extreme downward trajectory. Otherwise, there was a high probability he might inadvertently take innocent life in an attempt to save it. The dead man had breached the inner wall of the crowd and was now headed directly toward the street comedian. The eyes had taken on the glassy, thousand-yard stare. The lips were moving. Final prayers. The street comedian wrongly assumed the dead man wished to take part in the performance. Smiling, he took two steps toward him but froze when he saw the hands emerge from the pockets of the overcoat. The left was slightly open, the right was bunched into a fist with the thumb cocked at a right angle. Still, Gabriel hesitated. What if there was no detonator? What if it was a pen or a cylinder of lip balm? He had to be sure. "Tell me your intentions," he thought. "Sign your name." The dead man turned to face the market. The patrons, looking down from the balcony of the Punch and Judy, laughed nervously, as did a few of the spectators gathered in the piazza. In his mind, Gabriel silenced the laughter and froze the image. The scene appeared to him as though painted by the hand of Canaletto. The figures were stock still. Only Gabriel the Restorer was free to move among them. He slipped through the front row of the spectators and focused his gaze on the spot at the back of the skull. Firing at a downward angle was not possible, but there was another potential solution to prevent collateral casualties. An upward line of fire would carry Gabriel's round safely over the heads of the spectators and into the facade of the adjacent building. He pictured the maneuver in sequence, the cross-handed draw, the crouch, the shot, the advance, and waited for the dead man to sign his name. The silence in Gabriel's head was broken by a drunken shout from the balcony of the Punch and Judy, a command for the martyr to move out of the way and allow the performance to continue. The dead man responded by lifting his arms above his head like a long-distance runner breaking the finishing tape. On the inside of the right wrist was a thin wire leading from the detonator switch to the explosives. It was all the evidence Gabriel needed. He reached into his jacket and seized the butt of his Beretta. Then, as the dead man screamed, "Allahu Akbar!" Gabriel dropped to one knee and leveled the weapon toward his target. Remarkably, the shot was clear, with no chance of secondary casualties. But as Gabriel was about to squeeze the trigger, two powerful hands pulled the gun downward, and the weight of two men drove him toward the paving stones. At the instant he hit the ground, he heard a sound like the crack of thunder, and felt a wave of scorching air wash over him. For a few seconds Gabriel heard nothing more. Then the screaming started, a single shriek, followed by an aria of wailing. Gabriel lifted his head and saw a scene from his nightmares. It was body parts and blood. It was Baghdad on the Thames. 7. New Scotland Yard, London. There are few more grievous sins for a professional intelligence officer, even a retired one, than to land in the custody of the local authorities. Because Gabriel had long occupied a nether region between the overt and secret worlds, he had suffered such a fate more often than most of his fellow travellers. Experience had taught him there was an established ritual for such occasions, a sort of kabuki dance that must be allowed to reach its conclusion before higher authority can intervene. He knew the steps well. Fortunately, so did his hosts. He had been taken into custody within minutes of the attack and driven at high speed to New Scotland Yard, the headquarters of London's Metropolitan Police Service. Upon arrival, he was delivered to a windowless interrogation room, where he was treated for numerous cuts and abrasions and given a cup of tea, which he left untouched. A detective superintendent from the counter-terrorism command arrived in short order. He examined Gabriel's identification with the scepticism it deserved, and then tried to determine the chain of events that led Mr. Rossi to draw a concealed firearm in Covent Garden the instant before a terrorist detonated his suicide belt. Gabriel had been tempted to pose a few questions of his own. Namely, he wanted to know why two special firearms officers of the Met's SO-19 division had chosen to neutralize him, rather than an obvious terrorist about to commit an act of indiscriminate mass murder. Instead, he responded to each of the detective's inquiries by reciting a telephone number.
"Call it," he said, tapping the spot where the detective had written the number in his notebook. "It will ring in a very large building not far from here. You'll know the name of the man who answers. At least you should."
Gabriel did not know the identity of the officer who finally dialed the number, nor did he know precisely when the call was placed. He only knew that his internment inside New Scotland Yard lasted far longer than was necessary. Indeed, it was approaching midnight by the time the detective escorted him down a series of brightly lit corridors toward the entrance of the building. In the detective's left hand was a manila envelope filled with Gabriel's possessions. Judging from the size and shape, it did not contain a 9mm Beretta pistol. Outside, the pleasant weather of the afternoon had given way to a driving rain. Waiting beneath the shelter of the glass portico, engine idling softly, was a dark Jaguar limousine. Gabriel accepted the envelope from the detective and opened the rear door of the car. Seated inside, one leg crossed elegantly over the other, was a man who looked as though he had been designed for the task. He wore a perfectly fitted charcoal grey suit and a silver necktie that matched the colour of his hair. Normally his pale eyes were inscrutable, but now they revealed the strain of a long and difficult night. As deputy director of MI5, Graham Seymour bore a heavy responsibility for protecting the British mainland from the forces of extremist Islam. And once again, despite the best efforts of his department, extremist Islam had won. Though the two men had a long professional history, Gabriel knew little of Graham Seymour's personal life. He knew that Seymour was married to a woman named Helen, whom he adored, and that he had a son who managed other people's money for the New York branch of an important British financial house. Beyond that, Gabriel's knowledge of Seymour's private affairs was drawn from the office's voluminous file. He was a relic of Britain's glorious past, a by-product of the upper middle classes who had been bred, educated, and programmed to lead. He believed in God, but not with much fervour. He believed in his country, but wasn't blind to its shortcomings. He was good at golf and other games, but was willing to lose to a lesser opponent in service of a worthy cause. He was a man admired and, most important, a man who could be trusted, an attribute rare among spies and secret policemen. Graham Seymour was not, however, a man with unlimited patience, as evidenced by his dour expression as the Jaguar pulled into the street. He removed a copy of the next morning's Telegraph from the seat-back pocket and dropped it in Gabriel's lap. The headline read, "Reign of Terror." Beneath it were three photographs depicting the aftermath of the three attacks. Gabriel searched the photo of Covent Garden for any sign of his presence, but saw only the victims. It was a picture of failure, he thought. 18 people dead, dozens more critically injured, including one of the officers who had tackled him. And it was all because of the shot Gabriel had not been allowed to take.
"Bloody awful day," Seymour said wearily. "I suppose the only way it could get any worse is if the press finds out about you. By the time the conspiracy theorists are finished, they'll have the Islamic world believing that the attacks were plotted and carried out by the office."
"You can be sure that's already the case," Gabriel returned the newspaper and asked, "Where's my wife?"
"She's at your hotel. I have a team staying just down the hall."
Seymour paused, then added,
"Needless to say, she's not terribly pleased with you."
"How can you tell?" Gabriel's ears were still ringing from the concussion of the blast. He closed his eyes and asked how the SO-19 teams had been able to locate him so quickly.
"As you can imagine, we have a wide array of technical means at our disposal.
Such as my mobile phone, and your network of CCTV cameras?"
"Precisely," Seymour said. "We were able to pinpoint you within a few seconds of receiving Chiara's call. We forwarded the information to Gold Command, the Met's Operational Crisis Center, and they immediately dispatched two teams of specialist firearms officers."
"They must have been in the vicinity."
"They were," Seymour confirmed.
We were on high alert after the attacks in Paris and Copenhagen. A number of teams were already deployed in the financial district and spots where tourists tend to congregate. So why did they take me down instead of the suicide bomber? Because neither Scotland Yard nor the Security Service wanted a rerun of the Menezes fiasco. As a result of his death, a number of new guidelines and procedures were put in place to make sure nothing like it ever happens again. Suffice it to say, a single warning does not meet the threshold for taking lethal action, even if the source happens to be named Gabriel Allon. So 18 innocent people died as a result. What if he wasn't a terrorist? What if he was another street performer, or someone with mental problems? We would have been burned at the stake. But he wasn't a street performer, or a mental patient, Graham. He was a suicide bomber. And I told you so. How did you know? He might as well have been wearing a sign declaring his intentions. Was it that obvious?
Gabriel listed the attributes that first raised his suspicions and then explained the calculations that led him to conclude the terrorist intended to detonate his device at 2:37. Seymour shook his head slowly.
I've lost count of how many hours we've spent training our police officers to spot potential terrorists, not to mention the millions of pounds we've poured into behavior recognition software for CCTV. And yet a jihadi suicide bomber walked straight into Covent Garden, and no one seemed to notice. No one but you, of course.
Seymour lapsed into a brooding silence. They were headed north along the floodlit white canyon of Regent Street. Gabriel leaned his head wearily against the window and asked whether the bomber had been identified.
His name is Farid Khan. His parents immigrated to the United Kingdom from Lahore in the late 70s, but Farid was born in London, Stepney Green to be precise, Seymour said. Like many British Muslims of his generation, he rejected the mild, apolitical religious beliefs of his parents and became an Islamist. By the late 90s, he was spending far too much time at the East London Mosque in Whitechapel Road. Before long, he was a member in good standing of the radical groups Hizb-ut-Tahrir and Al-Muhajirun. It sounds to me as if you had a file on him.
We did, Seymour said, but not for the reasons you might think. You see, Farid Khan was the ray of sunlight, our hope for the future.
Or so we thought.
You thought you'd turned him around? Seymour nodded.
Not long after 9/11, Farid joined a group called New Beginnings. Its goal was to deprogram militants and reintegrate them into the mainstream of Islam and British public opinion. Farid was considered one of their great successes. He shaved his beard. He severed ties to his old friends. He graduated near the top of his class at King's College and landed a well-paying job with a small London ad agency. A few weeks ago, he became engaged to a woman from his old neighbourhood.
So you checked him off your list?
In a manner of speaking, Seymour said. Now it appears it was all a clever deception. Farid was literally a ticking time bomb waiting to explode.
Any idea who activated him?
We're poring over his telephone and computer records as we speak, along with a suicide video he left behind. It's clear his attack was connected to the bombings in Paris and Copenhagen. Whether they were coordinated by the remnants of Al-Qaeda Central or a new network is now a matter of intense debate. Whatever the case, it's none of your concern. Your role in this affair is officially over.
The Jaguar crossed Cavendish Place and stopped outside the entrance of the Langham Hotel.
I'd like my gun back. I'll see what I can do,
Seymour said.
How long do I have to stay here? Scotland Yard would like you to remain in London for the rest of the weekend. On Monday morning you can go back to your cottage by the sea and think of nothing other than your Titian.
How do you know about the Titian?
I know everything. Everything except how to prevent a British-born Muslim from carrying out an attack of mass murder in Covent Garden.
I could have stopped him, Graham.
Yes, Seymour said distantly. And we would have repaid the favour by tearing you to pieces.
Gabriel stepped from the car without another word.
Your role in this affair is officially over, he murmured as he entered the lobby.
He repeated it again and again, like a mantra.